Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a recent study testing theories of American politics, elites, interest groups, and average citizens that finds the U.S. is dominated by a rich and powerful elite and that the majority of Americans have little influence over the policies our government adopts. The co-author of the study, Martin Gillens, a professor of politics at Princeton University, whose research examines representation, public opinion, and mass media, especially in relation to inequality in public policy, joins us to discuss how, if the economic elite support a policy change, it has a 50-50 chance of being enacted, while if they oppose a policy, its chances of becoming law are less than 20%. Then we'll examine the takeover of Russia's equivalent of Facebook, VKontakte, by cronies of Vladimir Putin, forcing its founder, Pavel Durov, to flee Russia and declare that, unfortunately, the country is incompatible with internet business at the moment. Stephen Wilson, a doctoral student in political science at the University of Wisconsin, who teaches Russian politics and foreign policy, especially the effects of the internet and new communications technology on Russian politics, joins us to discuss Putin's move to first have friendly oligarchs buy up the internet, then for the state to totally control its content, as the Chinese do. Then finally, Jesse Katz joins us in the studio. He is a former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Los Angeles Times, who is now a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine, where his latest article is featured, Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. We will discuss the dramatic odyssey of the LA Dodgers star baseball player's fifth and final escape from Cuba into the hands of Mexican smugglers with ties to the murderous Zetas cartel, to Puig's $42 million contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers, a financial home run that many colorful characters involved in this shady saga are now laying claim to. And joining us now is Martin Gillens, who's a professor of politics at Princeton University, whose research examines representation, public opinion, and mass media, especially in relation to inequality and public policy. He's the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. His latest study with Benjamin Page is Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Gillens.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
And so much talk about an American oligarchy, of the growing disparity in the income gap, the wealth gap in America. All of this seems to be out there in the political zeitgeist and may well intensify in terms of a debate as the November elections approach. But I guess in a sense, your study is not just saying that the U.S. is dominated by a rich and powerful elite. It actually gets into the weeds, does it not, with 1,779 survey questions asked between 1981 and 2002 on these public policy issues that we're about to discuss.
Yes, that's right. We've spent quite a bit of time collecting an enormous amount of data, and with the help of many assistants, I should say. And the data covers this about 25-year period and really allows us to show, I think, for the first time, the relative ability of different groups or kinds of actors in this country to influence what our government does.
And in terms of the takeaway, the headline, my sense is that what you've shown here is that the majorities of the American public actually have little influence over policies our government adopts, but more specifically, if the economic elite in this country wants to push a policy or back a policy, it's basically got a 50-50 chance of succeeding in becoming law. And if our economic elite opposes any given measure or policy, that its chances of becoming law are less than 20%, in fact, 18%. So am I focusing on what you're delivering here?
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And I should point out that the actors that we show have influence over government policymaking include both affluent individuals, who we call economic elites, and organized interest groups, which primarily represent the business community. And you're quite right that when either of those, either the elite individuals, the wealthy individuals, or organized interests favor a policy change, that we find that that's much more likely to occur than when they oppose that policy change. But when ordinary Americans, who we measure by the sort of middle class, people at the 50th income percentile, their preferences on those same sets of policies seem to make essentially no difference in the likelihood of it being adopted or not.
So, in effect, the rich exercise a veto.
Yes, I think that's a reasonable way to put it. They don't always get what they want because we have a very sort of status quo-oriented political system, right? Our checks and balances and multiple veto points and so on does prevent even powerful interests from getting what they want much of the time. And yet it makes a big difference whether they favor or oppose some policy, and it makes, as I say, essentially no difference whether the middle class favors or opposes a policy.
So why is it then that you don't use the O word, the oligarchy? I mean, you seem to prefer the phrase economic elite domination.
That's true. In the media coverage of our work, the appeal of that term seems to be irresistible, but it's not a term that we use in the paper. And while different people mean different things by oligarchy, to me, it kind of conjures up this image of a, you know, very small number of extraordinarily wealthy and powerful individuals, you know, kind of pulling the strings. And I don't really think that's what's going on here. I think in America, influence over government is more widespread than that. It may not reach as far down, really, as the top 10%, maybe not even the top 1%, but it's not a few dozen, you know, rich people. And so we don't use the word oligarchy, and in fact are sort of hesitant at identifying any individual sort of subset of affluent Americans as those who have the power. I think it's fair to say that the more money, the more resources a person has, the better able they are to shape political outcomes. But it's kind of a gradual, you know, shading into less and less influence. And then by the time you get down to the middle class, as we find, there's essentially no ability or no responsiveness of government policymakers to the preferences of Americans at average income levels.
Well, it seems, though, that there's been for the longest time these conspiracy questions. I mean, I guess Hofstadter wrote a book about the paranoid style of American politics that's always suggested that there have been these shadowy elites, that the world is controlled by five white men in a back room somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, whether they be the Bilderbergers or the Trilateral Commission, et cetera. And that's been a sort of staple amongst the conspiracy theorists on the far left and the far right. But in effect, it looks like that the conspiracy theory version of reality is not so far off the mark, without, albeit not with mythical groups like Bilderbergers and Trilateralists, but with, well, describe this elite, if you will.
First let me say that my co-author in this work, Ben Page, is trying to get a much better sense of what truly wealthy Americans want and how they go about influencing the political system to get it. And the data that we have suggests that people at the top of the income distribution, but nevertheless, people who are captured by ordinary surveys, so these are not billionaires, maybe not even millionaires, although they may share many of the same views as those sort of more affluent and wealthy individuals. And it's this somewhat larger group of people that we have data on and that we show the preferences exerting an influence over government policymaking. So in our work, it's really a considerably larger set of individuals, and we don't really know to what degree they are themselves influencing government and to what degree they share the preferences of a smaller set of more affluent individuals. But as a group, it's very clear that once you start getting, you know, below the top of the income distribution, that influence falls off very quickly. Now, it is important to point out that there are many issues in which the middle class and the affluent share preferences. And on those sorts of issues, the prospects of the middle class getting what it wants is the same as the prospects for the affluent. So it's not that middle-class Americans never see the policies that they want adopted by their government. But what is the case is that whether they want those policies or not seems not to make much difference in what the government does.
So it's just the confluence of some policies that between the elite and the middle class.
That's correct. And I believe that that's why a considerable body of work in political science has interpreted its findings as showing the influence of middle-class Americans. That is, they've measured what average citizens want and related that to what the government does, but without taking into account the role of elites and interest groups. And so there's a false perception of influence that once you take those other actors into account, you see really fades away.
Well, isn't that the inherent dilemma that the modern Democratic Party has? It gets its votes from ordinary middle class and working Americans, but gets its money from the elite?
Yes, that's true. And to some degree, it's true for the Republican Party as well. Not as much, but especially on social issues, the Republican Party tries to appeal to lower income Americans. But as you suggest, it's really both parties that are dependent on the wealthy for the money that makes the political system run.
So is then the Koch brothers, is that our tendency just to simplify things, in the way that I mentioned the Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists, that the Koch brothers have become the new brand catchphrase for America's elite?
Well, it's certainly convenient to have, an enemy, if you will, that you can clearly identify. But I do think it's more complicated than that. And not to in any way diminish the power of people like the Koch brothers, which I do think is enormous and quite problematic. But nevertheless, that it's not some small group of wealthy individuals alone who are shaping what government does. Politicians, office holders, presidential candidates spend enormous amounts of time trying to raise money from not a huge number of people and not, for the most part, ordinary Americans, but nevertheless from a much broader range of wealthy individuals who have an interest in politics. So it's not just the sort of few people who grab the headlines. It's a somewhat larger group than that.
But it seems like when it comes to the crunch, the middle class are shut out, and the poor who don't tend to vote are totally shut out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just in closing then, Martin Gillins, what is your expectation of, I mentioned in this current sort of context with inequality being out there in the political zeitgeist and likely to intensify as we get towards the November elections, do you think this is an important moment in America to debate, even if you don't want to use the O word, oligarchy, at least we should be talking about the extent to which we are still a democracy and have become an oligarchy.
I completely agree, and that's why I'm so delighted that the paper that Ben and I wrote has generated so much interest. Whether people want to attach the word oligarchy to it or not, as I'm not especially concerned about, but I think that public debate about this issue is terribly important, and it's really only extraordinary pressure from large numbers of Americans and perhaps allies among the well-to-do that can bring about the kinds of changes, campaign finance reform and so on, that would be needed to make the American government more equally responsive to all of its citizens.
So how would we get hold? How do our listeners get hold of your study?
They can go to my webpage at Princeton University and follow the links there, or to Ben Page at the Political Science Department at Northwestern University. And we both have links to the paper, which will be published this coming fall in Perspectives on Politics, a political science journal.
And, of course, there's an article by John Cassidy at The New Yorker about your study, Is America an Oligarchy? And the BBC has also been covering it as well. So it's out there in the zeitgeist too, right?
Absolutely. I'm happy to say that there's probably a couple dozen different options on the web for people interested in our work.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Martin Gillins.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Martin Gillins, who's a professor of politics at Princeton University, whose research examines representation, public opinion, and mass media, especially in relation to inequality in public policy. He's the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. His latest study with Benjamin Page is Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. We're going to take a brief station break and be looking into Vladimir Putin's takeover of Russia's equivalent of Facebook.